Well, brothers and sisters, we're ready to begin our first class. It's with Brother Gillett, and he's going to deliver his fourth class on the subject, Bible Men the Way They Were. And the breakdown for today is entitled, Nehemiah, the Sword, and the Trowel. Now, before we call upon Brother Gillett, he's asked that we read another chapter, and that's Nehemiah chapter 6. Nehemiah chapter 6. Now it came to pass, Bible men, the way they were, Nehemiah, the sword and the trowel.
Good morning, everyone. There's not much detail about the person of Nehemiah in the book which bears his name. You'll notice, probably from your memory of the opening verses, that he is described as the son of Hakaliah, and was probably of the tribe of Judah. I say probably because there is no direct evidence as to his lineage. It is deduced rather than expressed. For instance, Nehemiah's kinsman, Hanani, seems to be of the tribe of Judah. I'm thinking of chapter 1, verse 2. It says, Hanani, one of my brethren, came, he and certain men out of Judah. And I asked them concerning the Jews that had escaped, which were left of the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. So it looks as though Hanani was of the tribe of Judah, one of Nehemiah's kinsmen. And then in chapter 2, verse 3, it looks as though Nehemiah's relatives were buried in Jerusalem. And I said unto the king, let the king live forever. Why should not my countenance be sad when the city, the place of my father's sepulchres, lieth waste, and the gates thereof are consumed with fire? So, it looks as though his relatives were buried there. And so, we deduce that he was of the tribe of Judah. But there is one thing about him which we can be sure of, and that is that he was evidently a man of some eminence. As the narrative opens, he is holding high office as the cupbearer of King Artaxerxes of Persia, and he was living in the winter palace, the residence of the king at Shushan. The king's full name is Artaxerxes Longimanus. And Shushan was a city, once the capital of a country called in the Bible Elam. The city came into the possession of the Babylonians and then in turn was captured and divided by Cyrus. And he transferred Shushan to the Persian dominion of his empire. From what you can read about it, it was an attractive place. It was called Shushan because of a variety of lily that grew there in profusion. For those of you who are interested in botanical matters, the lily is called Lilium Shushan. And because of that, the place was known as Shushan. Now, under Cyrus, this place became the metropolis of Persia, though indeed it's fair to say that some historians allege that it was Darius who established it rather than Cyrus. Doesn't matter. Point is that it was in this place, in the royal palace that Nehemiah the Jew emerges to our view as a man of importance and influence. Now, what we have to understand, brothers and sisters, is that Nehemiah was the civil patriot of his age, as Ezra, for example, was the ecclesiastical patriot. That is to say, amid the wreckage of forces around Israel, he welded together the attributes of nationalism by the force and the virtue of the law of God. It was the consolidation of Judaism, which later on was to solidify the nation in the face of the Greek and Roman influence and domination. Now, this morning, I am going to try to measure the power and the influence and the character of this man by trying to see his influence upon his comrades. I'm going to try to make the measurement by seeing the effect he had upon those who were with him. In other words, in a way, he is revealed in the characters of those whom he led. And I think we shall best do it by pondering the greatest event of his life, the thing which was really the master passion of the book of Nehemiah, that is, the building of the wall around the city of God. In that enterprise, Nehemiah is revealed in the men who did the work. Now, it's a remarkable thing when you ponder it that the book of Nehemiah really and simply is about the building of a wall. I mean, if it were a temple or a palace, it would be more impressive. But a wall, what could be more prosaic than building a wall? And can I just pause to say, I hope I don't offend any bricklayers in this house, because I have the deepest respect for their profession. You see, here is a startling thing. The building of that wall, in a way, is microcosmic of God's relationship with us. What happened at Jerusalem in 52 days is a microcosm of God's mighty purpose with the world. Now, those words which we may read in this book were written 2,500 years ago. They come to us with a pertinence sometimes which is uncanny. And the details of the narrative, as you ponder it, reveal a much deeper truth than would appear on the surface. Now, it may have happened a long time ago in what seems to us perhaps to be a remote corner of the world. But really, this is the word of God for such as we are. Now just think quickly, and let me just remind you of the event which preceded the work of Nehemiah. The people of God, as you know, were exiles in Babylon for a long time, and then a remnant under the leadership of Zerubbabel, and with the help of Cyrus the king, were driven to return to Jerusalem to build the house of the Lord in Zion. So they came to desecrated Jerusalem, and the first task was to build an altar so that the daily sacrifice could be restored. Following upon that, they commenced to build the temple of the Lord. But the work was halted by a decree from Artaxerxes. And so for 15 years, the house of God lay waste, overgrown with weeds, a scene of desolation. In other words, they began to build, but they were not able to finish. But later on, under the ministry of Haggai and Zechariah, the work was recommenced. The building of the house of the Lord, the house of Yahweh, was finished, and it was dedicated with great rejoicing. Now, some years after this, Nehemiah is found at Shushan, we've remembered already, as a high official in the court of Artaxerxes. There, as we may read in Nehemiah chapter 1, he receives reports from Jerusalem about the sad and unhappy condition of the city and of the residents of Judea. Chapter 1, verses 1 to 4. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. Now it came to pass in the month Chislev, in the 20th year, as I was in Shushan, the palace, that Hanani, one of my brethren, came, he and certain men out of Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews that had escaped, which were left of the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. They said unto me, the remnant that are left of the captivity there in the province are in great affliction and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem also is broken down, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. And it came to pass, when I heard these words, that I sat down and wept and mourned certain days, and I fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Now, that degenerate condition of the people and of the city, think of that and notice that that condition is focused in the fact that the walls of Jerusalem were broken down, and they were neglected and overgrown, and the gates of the city were burned with fire. In those facts, their sorrow and their sadness and their dejection is focused. Now you see, to us this is a strange thing. To Western ears, this does not make sense, really. I mean, we would regard it perhaps as a superficial thing, an external thing, an incidental thing. The walls are broken and the gates are burned. But we must seek to understand it, first of all, in the light of Eastern conception of life, and then in the context of that time, because broken walls and burned gates were the sign of neglect, of degradation and decadence. The condition robbed Jerusalem, really, of its true dignity as a fortified city. When the prophet Isaiah wishes to speak of the highest dignity and the noblest destiny of the city of Zion, this is what he says: wasting and destruction shall no more be within thy borders, but thou shalt call thy walls salvation and thy gates praise. When John the Apostle saw the vision of the new Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God, he saw and described the walls and the gates. And the walls were flashing with jasper, and every gate was a pearl. So the Hebrews felt like this. To the Hebrew mind, the walls and the gates were a telling and significant emblem of the greatness and the security of the city. And because of walls and gates preserved and intact, the things to be retained were retained, and the things to be excluded were excluded. Walls and gates represent keeping. Things kept out and things kept in. But when they are broken and decayed and burned with fire, where instead of strength there is rubble, where instead of safety there is ashes, so there is reproach and so there is sadness. Now this was the reproach and the sadness then which came to Nehemiah at Shushan from Jerusalem, and he wept and mourned and fasted and made prayer before the God of heaven. And we've seen that in that passage we looked at just now. Now I don't propose to go on and retell the story, because you will remember it well, I understand. In chapter 2, we can read of the king's permission to Nehemiah to go to Jerusalem, and he went, as you know, and the outcome of his visit to Jerusalem is the story of his success. I just want to bring you to three verses next. Chapter 2, verses 17 and 18. Chapter 2, verses 17 and 18. Then said I unto them, ye see the evil case that we are in, how Jerusalem lieth waste, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. Come, and let us build up the wall of Jerusalem, that he be no more a reproach. And I told them of the hand of my God, which was good upon me, and as also of the king's words that he had spoken unto me, and they said, let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hands for the good work. Now have a look at chapter 6, verse 15. Chapter 6, verse 15. So the wall was finished in the 25th day of the month Elul, in 52 days. We saw that resolution, and we're able to realize the execution. Now you see, between those two quotations, there is a story of courage, bravery, and endurance. And the purpose of this meditation this morning is to observe the man who came to do it, to mark his method with those who surrounded him, their response to his enthusiasm, their will to overcome difficulties, and so to discover the very elements which make for success. In 7 weeks, the wall was flung round the city of God. And what I have come to say today is that the things we see here are microcosmic of the work of God in every place and at every time. In other words, the principles which enabled those men to build the wall are timeless and perpetual. As you read the story, and as I know you've read it time and time again, you know that you discover again and again that the first element in their success, which they achieved, was a strong belief in the project itself. In other words, they were driven by a master passion. Now you see, I happen to believe that at the back of every life, there is a reason, a motive, an impulse. That is to say, behind everybody, there is a master force which drives them. It may not be recognizable, it may not be named, but it is there. Now I know what your response is, I can read your minds with respect. You are wanting to tell me that there are some people who seem to have no aim and no impulse and no master passion. That's what you're thinking. But I shall reply to you and say they do have a master passion, and it's a master passion to be lazy and shiftless. And it's sometimes surprising how hard they will work in order to achieve it. Earnestness and persistence usually bring their reward, and where the passion is strong enough, there is always the element of forgetfulness of self in the presence of the need to accomplish the great end which is in view. And so it was with these workers with Nehemiah. In the presence of the great need, each man and woman sank themselves and worked for the common good. In other words, the very vastness of the work itself, the project itself, produced in them a spirit of self-abnegation. In each individual, there was that spirit of self-abnegation, and then moving together towards the same end, having a common purpose, impulsed by the same master passion, that spirit in each man and woman became a corporate self-abnegation, and in that power, the work went forward. There was unity among the workers, but it was not an arranged unity. It arose out of the heart and spirit of each person, knit together by the same common purpose. It wasn't arranged. I mean, it wasn't the outcome of a consultation, or it wasn't the outcome of a committee meeting. Sometimes consultation and committees are good and necessary, but this was not the method here. I don't want you to think that I'm against committees. Please don't think that. I know that they're sometimes essential. You see, a man once told me that a two-humped camel was really supposed to be a horse, but it was arranged by a committee. Of course, I don't believe that. As a matter of fact, as far as I'm able to see, that there is only one reference in the book of Nehemiah to consultation. It's in chapter 5, verse 7, and Nehemiah says, "Then I consulted with myself and contended with the nobles." Well, sometimes, you know, self-consultation is very profitable. An audience of one sometimes is the best audience of all. I don't want you to all start rushing out. Having said that, I'd like you to stay, please. Now, anyway, the point is that this unity was not arranged. It was the outcome of a common need. It was the outcome of a common ambition. The self-denial was unconscious, in a sense. I know it's an old saying, and I know it's going to sound very trite, but unity is strength. We know it's true, really. Although it's an old-fashioned saying, we know in our deepest heart that it's true. Take a fine strand of hemp, shall we say, and you can break it. You can break it with two fingers. Take several and weave them together, and by that entanglement, skillfully arranged, a cable is created which will hold a ship against all the strains and stresses of the current, because unity is strength. And so it is with the men of God. When they built the wall, each man built that part which was over against his own house. That is to say, everybody did that which they were best able to do. They built high, but they didn't forget to build wide and broad as well. So that consequently, each man's work touched his neighbor's work. And as there was cohesion in their spirit, so consequently there was cohesion in the building. You see, when men build without reference to their neighbor, they tend to create gaps. And through the gaps, good things are lost. And through the gaps, bad things are infiltrated. Unity, then, is the first element in the struggle for success. Unity. Would to God it were in our presence, in our community. Because unity is strength. The next thing I ask you to remember is their consecration. The real idea behind consecration is that of discipline. Now, if you were to ask me for a definition of discipline, I would say it is submission to the law which is created by each particular circumstance. Let me give you an illustration of what I mean. See, when I was at school, there was one story I used to like best of all, perhaps. It was the story of the taking of Quebec by Wolfe. Now, I hope that the Canadians in this house won't be offended if I go through that and tell how the English captured Quebec. How they did it was this. They came by boat up the St. Lawrence River, and they were under the discipline of strict silence. They had to climb the Heights of Abraham by a narrow defile without a sound, without making a sound, because the top of that defile could be kept by 20 men easily if they were prepared and if they knew what they were about. So, silently, they came down the river. Silently, they climbed up the heights. And silently, they waited for the order to charge. That was consecration, and by their utter discipline, they took their objective. And one failure in the discipline would have brought disaster. Discipline is submission to authority, and out of it arises the call for endurance. You see, there was a man you can read about in this narrative of Nehemiah. It's in Nehemiah 3, verse 14, if you want to look at it. His name was Malchiah, the son of Rechab. Now, you can read there what he did. And the Dungite repaired Malchiah, the son of Rechab, the ruler of the district of Beth-Hekarim. He built it, and set up the doors thereof, and the bolts thereof, and the bars thereof. Every word in the Bible is important. There's a very unpleasant word there, which is very important. I expect you noticed it. He went and built up the Dung Gate. I don't suppose many people got trampled to death going to do that. It was the place where nobody wanted to go, you see, that's what I mean. I don't have to spell it out, do I? The place where nobody wanted to go. Malchiah went there, did the work, the most unpleasant, did it faithfully, did it well, not minding, stayed there till it was finished, bolts and bars and doors, not minding, discipline. There was another man who had a larger piece of work to do, perhaps, I don't know. Larger than some others, perhaps. His name was Shalom. And the record lets slip an interesting thing. It says, his daughters helped him. His daughters helped him. I wonder what lies behind the story of Shalom. No sons? No wife, perhaps, God knows. His daughters helped him. They went and built with their father. Nehemiah 3, verse 12 it is. Next unto him repaired Shalom, the son of Halohesh, the ruler of half the district of Jerusalem, he and his daughters. Must have been a good family. Well, the work went on in this way. The work went on through discipline and through endurance. But let us be impressed also by their consistency, brothers and sisters. And by consistency, I mean the all-roundness of them. You see, out of this narrative has come a phrase which is a commonplace phrase now, and we always think of it when we think of building this wall, and it's the phrase I've used in the subject, the sword and the trowel. The trowel was busy, and all the time those who worked with it were girt with the sword. Every man was building, but every man was ready for a battle. It was a splendid merging of caution and courage, a bringing together of the sense of danger and also a readiness to meet it at all costs. That's what I mean by consistency. All their forces and all their abilities bent to the project. Not piecemeal, not partial, nothing neglected which was necessary to completeness, nothing left undone which ought to be done. The whole idea perhaps is focused and condensed into one statement. It's in verse 9 of chapter 4, where it says, but we made our prayer unto God and set a watch against them day and night because of we made our prayer unto God and set a watch. That tells us that praying and preparing are not antagonistic. It tells us that trying and trusting are not contradictory. They are complementary. The sword and the trowel. Remember I said at the beginning that this story was microcosmic of God's purpose. Well, quickly now, I'm thinking of Luke chapter 14. Remember, in that chapter, Jesus is speaking to those who were seeking to be his disciples. People on the perimeter of discipleship, as it were. And he said to them, which of you, intending to build a tower, sitteth not down first and counteth the cost, whether he hath sufficient to finish it? Or what king going to make war against another king sitteth not down first and consulteth? Think of that. Which of you intending to build a tower? The trowel. Or what king going to make war? the sword. See how this is related across the centuries to the challenge of Christ. So therefore, whoever he be of you that forsaketh not all that he hath cannot be my disciple. The discipline, the very same situation, as it were, compressed into those few sentences of the Christ.
But in addition, and above all, this, observe, the central secret of their success. I believe it was enthusiasm. The secret of their success, fixed and focused centrally. And it was first revealed in Nehemiah. That's the thing. It was revealed in him and communicated to his brethren. It's expressed perhaps in one sentence in chapter 4, verse 6. It says, so we built the wall, and all the wall was joined together unto half the height thereof, for the people had a mind to work. That's the explanation. That is to say, their will was captivated by the prospect of the final outcome. So the task was commenced, it was continued, and it was completed. Now I want to tell you something about it. It was not done by talking. I know talking's important. I know that. I know it's important. At least I think it is. It wasn't done by talking, though. I mean, it may have started by talking, but bricks are not laid by talking. It wasn't done by speculating. It wasn't done by deprecating. It wasn't done by disparaging. It wasn't done by carping criticism. It was done by men with burning hearts and shining faces. It wasn't done in cold blood either. It was done with warmth and passion and enthusiasm. It was done by united, consecrated people. And proceeding from that enthusiasm comes a blessed quality which supports success, and that is stability. Think of the words of Paul to the Corinthian church. He said to the Corinthian ecclesia, he said, be ye steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. Now, steadfast and unmovable are interesting words. They appear to be alike, but they are not quite the same thing. Steadfastness is that strong, firm-backed quality of fidelity which stays at work however long it may take, however hard it may be, however much drudgery there may be in it, and however much weariness may result from it, that steadfastness. But unmovableness is the same quality, but in the face of opposition. Stability in the face of forces which are actively antagonistic, that is, unmovable. Now, Nehemiah and his brethren had to face active opposition, you know that. But this man refused to be hindered. He refused to be wooed away from the task for any reason whatsoever. And the spirit of Nehemiah permeated his comrades. You remember we read today how indignantly he said, should such a man as I flee? Or again, why should the work cease while I leave it and come down to you to talk? They could not be moved, they would not be hindered, because their enterprise was deeply rooted in the presence of the opposition, it became even more steadfast and unmovable. I'd like to remind you just quickly of the circumstances which constituted the opposition as we've read them in that sixth chapter. As you know, the opposition mainly was focused in three characters. There was Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem. Sanballat was a Moabite,
Tobiah was an Ammonite, and Geshem was an Arabian. And they combined to oppose and hinder Nehemiah in every possible way. No doubt in the first place, their opposition was provoked as a result of their jealousy. They also were in the service of the king, remember, and they were no doubt envious of Nehemiah's preferment and his advancement. And no doubt also Sanballat hated Jerusalem. And this confederation planned to fall upon the builders with arms to put a stop to the work, but the plan was thwarted by the prudence and the vigilance of Nehemiah, the sword and the trowel. The sword was always handy for defense, as well as the trowel for building. And then after that, another plan, as we read in that chapter, was to bring Nehemiah into a place of suspicion with the king. That is, they fabricated a report that he intended to set himself up as an independent king in Jerusalem as soon as the wall was completed. This nearly succeeded because the king may have halted the restoration until the position was clarified. I say it nearly succeeded, and he may have done so because I'm not sure. It hasn't been stated in so many words, but we can deduce certain things. Let me just give you an example. Have a look at Nehemiah 13. Going to read verses 1 to 7 of Nehemiah 13. On that day, they read in the book of Moses in the audience of the people, and therein was found written that an Ammonite and a Moabite should not enter into the assembly of God forever, because they met not the children of Israel with bread and with water, but hired Balaam against them to curse them, albeit our God turned the curse into a blessing. It came to pass, when they had heard the law, that they separated from Israel all the mixed multitude. Now before this, Eliashib the priest, who was appointed over the chambers of the house of our God, being allied unto Tobiah, had prepared for him a great chamber, where aforetime they laid the meal offerings, frankincense, and the vessels, and the tithes of the corn, and the wine, and the oil, which were given by commandment to the Levites, and the singers, and the porters, and the heave offerings for the priests. But in all this time, I was not at Jerusalem. That's an interesting statement. All this time, I was not at Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I went unto the king. After certain days asked I leave of the king, and I came to Jerusalem, and understood the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah in preparing him a chamber in the court of the house of God. It looks as though, you see, Nehemiah, for some reason, was recalled to Shushan, to King Artaxerxes, and all I'm saying is it might have been to clear his name because of the evil report which this trinity of evil men had circulated to the king in order to try to hinder the work. So Nehemiah and his brethren had to face active opposition, but he refused resolutely to be hindered or wooed away from the task for any reason, and this spirit permeated his brethren. Now can I finally draw attention to one other vital factor, brothers and sisters? As I read the record, one thing strikes me finally, what I would call the sobriety of the rank and file. Now, I use the word sobriety in its pure sense, that is, steady, balanced, and solemn. That is, the good plodding work of all the men whose names are not written in this narrative, but whose deeds made the success possible. In the final analysis, you see, great enterprises are nearly always won by the steady, sober, self-controlled faithfulness of ordinary people. I know there's a place for the meteoric. I know there's a place for the volcanic element. I know that. But it is not that really that wins the victory very often. I mean, nature can be an illustration. There's a place in nature for the volcanic, but it's nearly always occasional. I think you will agree that. The volcanic is occasional. It's never regular. Not long ago, I was reading something about the little islands in the Pacific. Most of them are things of beauty and wonder, I understand. Occasionally, one of these islands was thrown up suddenly overnight, a volcanic island. But the truth is, the great majority of them didn't come in this way at all. The majority were formed by the tedious, persistent work of coral insects, operating over thousands of years, adding year by year to the formation and beauty of the coral reef. And that, in a way, is a figure. This is how it is with the work of God. You see, when the city of God is finally built, and when the Lord's purpose is finally manifest, there will no doubt be recognition of those who did things explosively, who did things suddenly and magnificently, and meteorically. But there will also, perhaps most of all, there will be recognition of those who didn't, of those who worked quietly and steadily, going on when the way was hard, going on when the shadows were dark, when the way seemed full of hopeless monotony, going on in spite of the opposition, not minding the antagonism, seeing their duty clearly and doing it faithfully and quietly. This is how the wall was built, and this is how it goes on being built. There are those here today in this house I know who were building the wall 50 years ago, in the truth, and they still are. And they have come through the stress and the toil and the storm. They have prayed and they have hoped and they have believed and they have wrought and they are beloved for their faithfulness. And we know in our hearts that the day is coming when the city of God shall be finally built, when its jasper walls will flash with glory, when its streets will shine with gold, and God's victory will be won. But it's not won yet. It's this vision on the distant boundary which fills us with the master passion. And if you add to that master passion the spirit of self-abnegation, and then the readiness to work, that is doing the thing which we are best able to do, doing that which is nearing us, nearest to us, doing that, the next thing, doing it gladly. Accepting the discipline of the Word of God, being steadfast and unmovable, ready to build and ready to battle, never diminishing our enthusiasm, doing it in warm blood, with a passion, merging courage and caution, with stability and quiet steadiness and self-control. So the wall will be built. And in the light of all this then, and accepting the principle that I proposed to you at the beginning, that the character of Nehemiah is revealed in the life of those he led, how finally shall we mark and measure him? Well, first of all, it seems to me that you have the idea that this man had a very strong and strenuous personality. Fervor is one of his great attributes, his absolute fidelity to the cause. I've said before, I don't know whether I said it at this school, but I've said it before on this tour, that personally I place on loyalty a great deal of emphasis. I love men who are loyal. When you've been a recording brother for a long time, then you learn that. It's loyal men who care. As I said before, I'll forgive a man a lot if he's loyal for the truth. I'll forgive him for having a different opinion from myself. I'll even forgive him for thinking his intellect is better than mine. If he's loyal, if he'll join hands with me and be true to the faith, Now, Nehemiah was this kind. His absolute fidelity was the secret. The master passion mastered him. Then you add to that the three outstanding things, honesty and tact and sagacity. And under his influence, not only did the work go forward from dawn till dusk, but the people themselves, they grew stronger and better in nerve and life as the work went on. The inspiration provided by Nehemiah resulted in a resurrection of a national spirit of independence, which perhaps had been slumbering for some time, dormant and unrecognized. Nehemiah was a strong man, but he found it difficult to tolerate schemers and fiddlers and skivers. He was a reformer, he was a man of action, the civil patriot of his age. As Ezra, as I said, was the ecclesiastical patriot. And through him, the men of the nation were consolidated. They were ready for the trials which were lying ahead of the race. He was no theorizer. There are too many of them, I fear. He was a man of faith and work, a strong man, but at the same time a sensitive man. You see, sometimes strong men tend to become hard, and sometimes sensitive men tend to become weak. It seems to me that in Nehemiah the opposing forces are rightly merged, a balanced merging of all these forces. He is a humble man and yet compelled to honesty. He spoke the truth truthfully. See, earnest men in this world have no time for subtleties. Nehemiah is straightforward in his speech, in his passion, in his life. And I think in that lay his greatness. And it was by that he built the wall around the city of God. And he built in the hearts and the spirits of those men who were with him the devotion and the dedication to the cause of God that brought success. So in the recollection of his example, Let us take courage, brethren and sisters. In the final sense, the wall is not yet built. But it will be. God be praised, it will be. That is the master passion of our faith. That is the pole star of our life. It's the one thing that nerves us in the day of battle. It steels us in the face of opposition. It will be built. And why are we so sure it will be built? What is the force of our assurance? Because there was one who came after Nehemiah, the man of the ages he was, and he came like Nehemiah, and he visited the ruin and inspected it, and then he gave all and placed all at the disposal of God for the winning of the victory. And taking counsel with no man save God only, he did what had to be done, and he is coming again soon to write the summary of the building and of the battle of the ages. And do you know what he is going to write? The wall is finished. Those words express the triumph of God's victory among men. The wall is finished. Now these things will be ours, brethren and sisters, according as we stand with him now, in the spirit of Nehemiah, building and fighting until the work is done.